These matters are being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted. When you begin your argument, please state your name and identify your client and let us know how we can reference you this morning. And with that, counsel, whenever you are ready, we are ready for you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Daniel Eaton for the appellants in the case. The district court erred in two ways by allowing the eviction in this case. First, the district court required only a one-month notice to vacate instead of a three-month notice. And second, the district court ruled on appellant's retaliation defense by making a conclusion of law related to title to the property, which is beyond the jurisdiction of the court in an eviction matter. And the district court did not make findings showing that the respondent rebutted the presumption of retaliation. I'll first talk about the three-month notice to vacate issue. And as you can probably see by the briefing, this seems to come down to the question of what is defined as rent in this particular case. And the cases that the respondent relies upon to define rent are niche cases that don't have any application in this scenario. Two of them, the Nelson's Office Supply case and the Royal Mineral Association case, those all relate to how you make calculations for tax purposes and what qualifies as rent, and effectively what qualifies as income.
But the definition used in Nelson's Office Supply is broader than that, right? I mean, it goes to Black's Law Dictionary and describes rent as it's currently defined in Black's as being consideration paid for the use or occupation of property. Why wouldn't we consider that applicable in this context?
So the way to look at this is what was really happening here. It's very clear from the testimony at trial and the record of the case that the arrangement between the parties was that the appellants lived in the property, and they just covered the costs of the property. They paid the mortgage, they paid the utilities, they paid the taxes, they paid the insurance, they maintained and kept up the property. There was no set rent, there was no set period that they were supposed to do it. They were just supposed to cover these costs.
I mean, those costs are incurred monthly.
At least some of them are, yes. Insurance, for example, generally is paid on an annual basis. Some utilities are paid on quarterly basis.
Let's rewind it. Are you claiming that the statute is ambiguous and that there's more than one reasonable interpretation as to what rent is? And if so, what are the multiple reasonable interpretations?
So the statute, are you referring to the statute within 504B? The statute does not define rent, and so yes, absolutely, there are different interpretations of that, and the way that I think this court should look at it is basically a totality of the circumstances view, and so what we have here is. We did not have a lease. There was no agreement to pay rent. There was an agreement to
rent as defined as what?
Rent as defined as a regular like a month. Because we have to look at the rent term in this case. Backing up, if you recall the. When it comes to a notice to quit, The notice has to be provided within the rent term, which usually is going to be a month, or within 3 months if there is no rent term, or if there, say, if the rent term were 3 months, then the notice of quit would have, notice to quit would be 3 months as well.
Let me give you a different example. Say that there's an agreement between a landlord and a tenant that the tenant will be essentially the superintendent of the property, and that is how the tenant covers the cost, or the landlord is going to recoup the costs of allowing the tenant to remain on the property. And some months that involves plumbing repairs or electrical repairs. Some months it involves snow removal. Some months it involves mowing the grass, and it's not at regular intervals. In your view, what would be the duration if the landlord of notice that the landlord would have to provide to the tenant to evict the tenant under those circumstances, when there aren't regular intervals of sort of an exchange for or consideration for living on the property?
It'd be 3 months.
And why?
For the exact reason that you just stated, there are no regular intervals. If you don't have regular intervals, how are you going to calculate the rent term?
But let's get closer to the facts of this case, because the mortgage was due every month, right?
Yes.
So my question for you is, I mean, there's a lot of situations where a landlord, the owner of a property, basically just collects the amount of rent necessary to cover the mortgage and insurance. And does it matter that the tenant in this situation, if they are a tenant, in fact, was paying the money directly to the bank for the majority of the tenancy, and versus if they gave the money to the landlord who then paid it to the bank? And what about a situation where the landlord says, here's my property manager, you give this to this third party, let's just call it mortgage payment every month, and then that third party pays the bank? Is that no longer a regular payment that's compensation for the tenant's use of the property simply because it's going either directly to the bank or some third party first?
Well, I think it depends, but, and I'll explain why here. The difference is, in this case, it was, first of all, very clear that the tenants, as they were, just paid the expenses directly to whoever those expenses were to be paid.
The exception of 1 month or so, right?
Right, and that was due to the fact that they had gotten involved in litigation. And so in your scenario, it would depend on, well, what exactly was their agreement? Was their agreement, you must pay X dollars to this person each month? Or was your agreement, you just cover the expenses, whatever they are and whenever they are due? And so that's what I think it comes down to.
The statute doesn't define rent, right? I mean, it doesn't say it needs to be this fixed amount. And a tenancy at will, they could, you know, that can change, right? The amount of agreed upon rent from month to month.
Yep.
So I don't understand why that drives, you know, I guess the challenge I'm having is we have some definitions of rent set forth by the Supreme Court, albeit in a different context. And it seems to make a lot of sense that it's consideration paid for the use of property. And to Judge Frisch's example, sometimes that consideration might be through services, like your counterpart pointed out in their brief. Sometimes it might just be paid directly to the bank. Why isn't that rent for purposes of the statute?
So the question, but so it could still be considered rent, and the court could still find that we still don't have a set rent term. Again, remember that what we're looking at is
what's, if it's considered rent and it's paid every month, like it was in this case, because that's when the mortgage was due, why wouldn't the rent term then be 30 days under
yes.
the statute?
And because it's happenstance that it was paid every month. It's just that that's in most mortgages, that's when you pay it.
But is it really happenstance in this case? Because if they didn't make that mortgage payment, that's a problem, right? That's a violation of the terms of the agreement by which they were allowed to stay on the state, live in the property.
Well, to give you a counter example, what if they didn't make the mortgage payment, but then and then worked out a arrangement with some sort of forbearance agreement with the lender, and so. It's easy to look at this and just say, well, they had to make these particular payments every month, so therefore there was a one-month term. But there was not a specific agreement between the landlord and the tenant. You must make, you know, this amount of payment every month. It just so happens that the mortgage payments are a monthly payment. Certainly some utility bills are monthly payments. But taxes are not monthly payments. Insurance are not monthly payments. And so it comes down to the, you know, what was their agreement? Their agreement was not pay X dollars every month. Their agreement was pay all the expenses.
It seems, Mr. Eaton, that you're trying to say, at least as I hear your argument, that even though there was, in this instance, a monthly requirement to pay that mortgage, there were other expenses that were not necessarily monthly, and therefore that negates the definition of the mortgage as rent. Am I correct in what you're arguing?
I wouldn't say that's exactly the way that I'm framing it. It's not that just because there are other payments that were not monthly, it's because that it just so happens that there were some payments that were monthly and some payments that were not, but that's different than paying a monthly amount, a set monthly amount, or even if it fluctuates based on factors, there was not a set monthly. The requirement was not you pay a certain amount per month. The requirement is you pay the expenses.
Right. Can you direct us to any case law that really would address this circumstance, that, you know, this argument you're making where some expenses are monthly, others are not?
I didn't find any case law. There is pretty limited case law on this. So, I do want to touch briefly on the rental license issue.
I just ask one additional question to follow up on
Sure.
Talbert's question. The additional argument I think that you're making is that rent has to be a fixed obligation and can't be a fluctuating obligation. Is there some authority for that proposition?
Again, there's not specific authority on this. The question really is what qualifies as the term of the rent, not necessarily what qualifies as rent.
And it's not unusual, I don't think, for a rental contract to provide that the tenant is responsible for utilities or snow removal, which are obviously not, necessarily always monthly obligations.
Right, and if that was the only thing if that were the tenant's only financial responsibilities, then you'd be looking at a three-month notice to quit. Regarding the rental license, I think that court can take, going to this, you know, totality of the circumstances view, I think the court can take that into consideration because the landlord in this case did not even view this as a rental property. The landlord clearly didn't view this as rent. Because had he done so, one would presume he would have gotten a rental license. So I think that should also be a factor here. I see I'm low on time. I'd like to touch on the other argument. I guess I will just make a couple quick points. I think this issue is briefed pretty well. The lower court can't make findings related to title, any interest in title, and it does appear that that's how the lower court ruled on the retaliation defense. And then also, in the court's order, the judge said that the plaintiff, the tenant did not prove retaliation. It appears that the court put the burden on the tenant to prove retaliation, when in fact it was the landlord's burden to prove lack of retaliation. I see I've just got a few seconds left, so I'll save anything else for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, Mr. Eaton. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal at your option. Counsel, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is John Westrick, counsel. Going to this notice thing, but the first thing I have to say is there's an elephant in the room here that just has to be discussed. It affects every issue in this case, and that is, what do we do when the person occupying the premises says, I have a contract for deed that's not enforceable as a matter of law? And how does that affect an eviction matter, even with respect to the notice thing? In order for the court to grant the relief the way the appellant wants it to grant it, it has to start making the equitable determinations that the statute and the courts repeatedly say you can't make unless it's the only form available.
Is that necessarily true, though? Because I think from your counterpart's perspective, it's the assertion of the right, not the determination of the right, that shifts the burden to your clients to prove that this wasn't retaliatory. And well, so the district court, I think from their perspective, didn't necessarily need to make the ultimate determination that there was a right there, simply recognize that there was an assertion of the right, and then look to you and your clients to prove by a preponderance that there was no retaliation.
I'll jump then to the retaliation. The court below found that the reason why the respondent started the eviction action was to sell the house to get a better house for him and his family. That's a finding that's in the record. It's supported in the record. And so that is enough on its own to overrule a claimed retaliation defense. Even if we had the burden, which because it has to be rebutted, I'll concede that. But the court made that finding. I'd like to go back to the notice provision, however, just a little bit. The record doesn't really talk about how the utilities are paid. The record doesn't talk about how insurance is paid. The record doesn't talk about how taxes and pays are paid. Usually within mortgage, you have taxes and insurance are in part of it, but it was a monthly payment. And what counsel wants us to do is focus on how it was actually paid, as opposed to the statute really focuses on how it was supposed to be paid, on when it was due. So if your, quote, rent, end quote, is due monthly, then you get 3 months' notice. We're taking what's a limited portion of the statute for purposes of notice and trying to turn it into a what is rent. I did find those Supreme Court cases. They are from a different context. But I also note that Black's Law Dictionary definition is the common law definition. I actually cited to Blackstone's. And so the courts usually in Minnesota follow a common law until it's changed by the legislature. So we have a monthly main payment. If some of the other payments are due every 38 days or whatever, it doesn't matter. Is it an abuse of discretion for the trial court below to say your principal payment you have to make is a monthly payment, so you get a monthly notice? And that's where our position is with that, is that that was reasonable given where we are. With respect to the retaliation claim, you can't get into the retaliation claim without going down what I'll call the equitable rabbit hole. We're gonna follow the big white rabbit down. And remember, the Cloverdale court says that a contract on which your retaliation claim is based has to be a landlord-tenant contract. It has to be something about the landlord-tenant. So in Cloverdale, there was a labor dispute, and they and the Cloverdale company, the quote landlord, said, "We don't like you being involved in this, so we're not going to renew your lease." And they said that was retaliatory, and the Cloverdale court said, "No, we're not doing it that way. This is some kind of outside thing, and we're not going to get into it." Likewise,
can I ask you? I'm sorry to interrupt. I just was, you know, you had pointed out earlier that the court made this finding that the basis for the sale was the was not retaliation, or the notice to quit, or the eviction notice was not retaliation, but was because the landlord wanted to sell the property. But the district court didn't actually make an express finding in its written order on that fact, and I think that's what Mr. Eden was pointing to, is that it seems like the way I read the district court's order, the district court discredited there being any valid right to shift the burden to your client, and then said there's otherwise insufficient evidence to prove that the notice to vacate was retaliatory. So why should we assume that the district court made that finding, that the basis for the notice to vacate was, in fact, your client's desire to sell?
Well, the district court found that they hadn't proved their retaliation defense, and I will concede that maybe in this instance the burden was on my client below. I don't think it matters, because I don't think the contract here that we're talking about is one that would raise up a retaliation defense, because in order to raise it, in order to have something done about it, you're going to have to go down into the whole equitable thing. You're going to have to do it. And what happens then if you allow a contract, a retaliation claim for an unenforceable contract for deed, you are in effect making the contract somewhat enforceable. If you're saying it's unenforceable as a matter of law, or it at least presumptively, from a point of view, then to say, well, I get to raise this thing and you can't do anything about it when I raise it.
But do you lose if we disagree with that? And to go back to what I was asking earlier, it is what I understand to be Mr. Eden's argument, that the court doesn't need to determine whether or not his clients have title or a valid claim. They just need to determine that they asserted a right based on, and that after that, the burden shifts to you, and then we look at the record and we don't see that the court made a finding by preponderance that your client was not acting in a retaliatory manner when the notice to vacate was served. So, I mean, do you lose under that scenario if the law is they don't need to make this determination and go down that rabbit hole?
But by saying you're asking to be able to raise and use as a retaliation defense an unenforceable contract, you have now taken an unenforceable contract and made it enforceable, or at least enforceable in part.
But in other contexts, so when the claim is that the notice to vacate is based on complaints about habitability, for example, and the district court in that situation, we're in a summary proceeding, the district court doesn't need to determine whether or not those habitability complaints are in fact valid, right? The district court then just determines if the notice to vacate was not retaliatory, right?
Correct.
That doesn't actually need to make. So why isn't that the same thing as this?
Because a habitability claim is a lawful defense. It's a lawful claim. It's something that the law recognizes. But here, this is a quote, I'm putting in quotes, contract that is presumptively and by statute unenforceable. And so if you say, well, you can raise an unenforceable contract as a defense, and then it has all of a sudden this shield, it's a shield to do things, then you have necessarily made the contract somewhat enforceable, even when it's not.
I'm a little confused now, and maybe even a little concerned. So say we have a tenancy that is not, there's no lease sign, it's just a tenancy at will, somebody's month to month in a house, and they may be a person of color. And the landlord sells a property, there's a new landlord, and the new landlord says, I don't like this person of color, and I'm going to evict them. And that is a retaliatory, illegal eviction. What do we do? Are you saying there's no possibility for a retaliation claim under those circumstances because there's no contract?
No, what I'm saying is there's, in this instance, there's no retaliation claim because there is no claim. The law doesn't recognize this as a lawful claim. A racial claim would be law.
What do you mean this as a lawful claim? What is the this?
Okay, I have a contract for deed. What they said below is because we have an oral contract for deed and have tried to enforce our oral contract for deed rights, now we're being retaliated against. But they have no right to enforce. That's the point. Whereas if you have the racial animus, that's a legitimate argument that the law recognizes. So, I mean, our point is if the basis of your retaliation claim has to be a lawful claim, it has to be something that the law says we're going to protect, not, well, he threw out my shoes, so I complained that he threw out my shoes. That's the problem here. We is that in order to recognize this as a claim, you necessarily make the unenforceable contract for deed enforceable in some way, shape, or form. You give it a legitimacy that the law by statute doesn't give it.
Go ahead.
I'm giving a lot of hypothetical examples today. What if they asserted a defamation claim, right? And the defamation claim was not meritorious. He said something bad about me, and I didn't like it, and it harmed my reputation, but it wasn't a meritorious claim. Is it the same situation that you're talking about now?
Cloverdale says that's not a landlord-tenant contract, so it can't be the basis of a retaliation claim. That's what Cloverdale says.
That was actually along the lines of what I was going to ask you. So under 504B 285 sub 2 parent 1, the lease or contract that the rights that they're seeking to enforce has to be the landlord-tenant contract, right?
Correct. That's what Cloverdale says.
But that's what makes this a little bit different, right? Because the claim contract they're kind of mixed, right? It's a contract to both purchase the property, an oral contract to purchase the property, and to occupy the premises, right?
Correct.
Like an oral contract for deed.
But you can't have an oral contract for deed, at least presumptively. And that's why the whole basis for the retaliation claim isn't there. But then I think also this court just recognizes when the trial court makes a decision, implicit findings of fact. And when they say they didn't make out the retaliation claim, we have evidence in the record as to why this was done, I question whether or not really that's something that this court should and could, well, I shouldn't say could, but should overturn. And I just want to again point out that the whole ownership thing is a red herring. Title is in my client. Record title is in my client. So a determination now that there's a record title and my client is the owner and thus can decide who possesses the property is not going to limit what happens in the companion lawsuit, which is currently pending, whereby there are equitable claims being made that says, hey, no, even though record title is here, it's actually held, you know, in trust or however you want to say it for the appellants. Unless there are any other questions, my client thanks the court for its time and attention.
Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. East, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you. I'll touch on the question of the district court's determination of the illegal agreement or the presumptively unenforceable agreement. The questioning from the court, I think, indicates that I believe the court understands this correctly, which is it doesn't matter I will back up. Yes, statute of frauds says you can't have an oral contract to purchase property or real estate, but there are multiple exceptions to that. One of them being what's called a constructive trust, which is the subject of the parallel lawsuit here. And so the district court had no no basis to touch that question. It is exactly as the court here has indicated, which it's making that, bringing that up to the landlord.
Can I ask you, so you cited Amresco, a residential mortgage company, in your reply on this point.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that struck me about that, I wanted to ask you if you disagree, it seems like, you know, in that case, you cited it for the proposition that the eviction court can't rule that a foreclosure is unlawful, right?
Right.
In the eviction action, can't make that determination.
Right.
But that was, a foreclosure action is a determination as to who, you know, should have title to the property that's outside the eviction context, and that's already determined in Amresco, and then the eviction court's, like, collaterally attacking that or setting it aside, right? So that's not the situation here. There was no legal determination of your client's rights under this construct. That whole action was instituted after the fact.
Right.
So how does Amresco help you given that distinction?
So I think the way to look at it is if the eviction court would have said, oh, hey, I guess this was an unlawful foreclosure, therefore there's no basis to evict. That's how this case applies there. In that case, the court...
The flip side be, like, if you had gotten a constructive trust determined prior to this action being initiated, and then his client served the notice to vacate, and then the district court made some contrary determination, there's already been a determination of rights in that situation. In this situation, the district court just has to look at the validity of the claim because there isn't a separate action that's determined that. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, I'm going to answer that in a way that I don't know directly answers your question, but I think it will answer your question, which is, again, going back to the point the court has been making is this is a retaliation defense. And so in this case, the clients had asserted their rights under what they believed was a contract, and then the notice to quit came. In your example, that's not applicable because the court has already ruled that a borrower can't make a retaliation defense on a foreclosure because there wasn't at the time a landlord tenant relationship, again, it's the question of the record is clear that my clients asserted these rights. Hey, we had this agreement; you were going to sell us the house for the amount that you paid for it, and then the notice to quit came. And Mr. Westrick has been trying to make the point that that was an illegal contract, or that's an unenforceable contract, but that is not a decision that the district court can make in an eviction action. All the court looks at is, was this asserted? And it's not a question of whether it's legal or illegal, it's a question of whether it's good faith. That is what the statute says. And it clearly was good faith because there is a good faith argument that they have a right to purchase the property, and that's what's being addressed in the parallel matter. So I see my time is up. I thank the court.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted. We appreciate your helpful submissions today, helpful argument and your helpful submissions. We will issue an order or an opinion within the statutory time period.